Okay, thanks. First, I'd like to thank the organizer for giving me the opportunity to speak here. So this talk will be about quantum Hall effects on lattice. So this talk involves some work in collaboration with Masaki, who is here, and Yingran from BC, and a student Jiaxin Wu from OSU, and Jason Ho from OSU. So the outline of the talk is the following. So first, I will give you some motivation about why I'm interested in this problem, and what are the major results we have in this work. So basically, it contains two parts. The first part is about quantum Hall effect on a lattice, which breaks Hamilton symmetry. So I'm going to describe some condition on the electron filling number and the Hall conductivity of the system in a lattice model when there are flux threaded through the lattice. So this is the first part. We'll discuss first the integral quantum Hall effect, then fractional quantum Hall effect. So second part, we'll focus on a case, special case with Hamilton symmetry. In that case, we'll have pi flux in every unit cell, so such that the system still doesn't break Hamilton. So in that case, I'll tell you that there is a no-go theorem, tells you that at certain filling, you must have a quantum spin Hall ground state if the ground state is a gapped insulator with no intrinsic topological term. Okay, so everyone knows quantum Hall effect, so I think I don't need to say too much here. So, but one thing I do want to say is that in a classical picture, a classical limit, if you compute the Hall conductivity, or the which is the inverse of the Hall resistivity, you'll get a straight line for its dependence with the magnetic field, meaning that Hall resistivity would be linear proportion to magnetic field in a system. So actually, this straight line also holds in quantum system when there are no disorder. But when you put disorder in the system, certain plateau develops, and that's why we observe quantum Hall effect in the system. So let me clarify that point a little bit more in the next two slides, since it's intimately related to the motivation of this talk. Okay. Oh, by the way, whenever you have any question, just stop me and ask. Yeah. So, so in fact, in a continuum, when the system have Galilean invariance, you can show that for a generically interacting system, the Hall conductivity is also fully determined by the electron density in a system. This is because of the following way. So I basically go through this very carefully. So imagine I study a non-relativistic quantum mechanical problem of a two-dimensional electron gas. They move under a magnetic field with certain electric potential. Imagine that electric potential doesn't break Galilean invariance, and when the electron can also interact with each other. And now you can ask yourself, okay, what's the Hall conductivity of the ground state? And in fact, Galilean invariance tells you that Hall conductivity must be the same as a filling fraction, as shown in the following way. So this is because whenever you have Galilean invariance, you can actually always perform a Galilean boost to transform from one framework to another framework. For example, if we want to look at the Hall conductivity of a system in the lab frame, we go to a moving frame. This moving frame has a finite velocity. So when I go to this moving frame, every physical quantity transform going from the lab frame to the moving frame. For example, momentum transforming this way, the momentum in the moving frame will be the original momentum in the lab frame minus m times b. M is a mass of the electrons, non-relativistic mass, and v is the velocity difference between the two frames. And also, position would also transform accordingly. And in the same time, electric field and magnetic field also transform accordingly. So magnetic field in particular doesn't change in the two frame, but the electric field also changes according to this transformation law. So now, whenever you study the Hall conductivity in the lab frame, what you actually do is that you apply some electric field, and then you observe what's the perpendicular current which propagates perpendicular to the electric field. And then you compute the ratio of the perpendicular current to the electric field. That gives you the Hall conductivity. So now when you go to the lab frame, the electric field and magnetic field both changes. In particular, if you choose a proper velocity between the two different frames, you can show that in the moving frame, the electric field goes to zero, right? In particular, when you choose the velocity to be this way, according to this transformation law, in the moving frame, you don't see any electric field. This means in the moving frame, no electric field. So all the charges stay there. They don't move at all. So in the moving frame, there's no electric current. And now you can do the Galilean transformation back to the lab frame, then to ask yourself, what's the current in the lab frame? And now you can convince yourself in the lab frame, the current is simply the electron density, which doesn't transform under Galilean transformation, times the velocity difference between the two different frames. Therefore, you get the relation between the transverse current and the electric field. So now you can see that indeed this Hall conductivity, which is a coefficient between the current and the electric field, is actually 1 over b. It's inverse proportion to the b. So this means in whenever we apply Galilean invariance, we actually get a very powerful conclusion for two-dimensional electron gas. Even if the electrons are interacting, for generically interacting Hamiltonian, as long as we have Galilean invariance, we always know that the Hall conductivity, which is essentially this this coefficient between the current and electric field, is given by the filling fraction in proper units, the units E squared over H. And the units, this filling fraction is defined as a ratio between the charge density and flux density. So in this case, you can show that whenever you have Galilean invariance, which is a continuous symmetry, no matter how complicated the Hamiltonian is, as long as it preserves the symmetry. So as long as we know the microscopic input of the model, which is the flux density, B, and the electron density, rho, whenever you know the two quantities, you also know the Hall conductivity. So without doing any calculation, you know the quantity. So this is actually a very powerful result, which applies to any continuum system with Galilean invariance. It's universal, independent of the form of the interaction. So this actually, the motivation of this work is actually to extend this continuum situation to the lattice case. So the question what in particular interested in is that, imagine I consider a crystalline lattice. In a crystalline lattice, the continuous Galilean symmetry is actually broken. So you don't have Galilean invariance. In the end, the symmetry which is still preserving the system are just a few discrete symmetry, which are basically lattice translation and some point group symmetry. Or maybe there could be some non-symmorphic symmetry, so basically some space group symmetry. And also you have charge conservation. So now the question we're trying to address is that in this situation, if I know the electron density, if I also know the flux density which is applied to the system, can I determine the Hall conductivity of the system? Can this symmetry give us certain condition between the Hall conductivity and the electron density? So like I have just said, we are really motivated by this generic relation, which relates some microscopic quantity which is already known in the model, such as electron density and flux density, and some property which we don't know, which some specific property of the ground state, which is Hall conductivity. We're trying to show, is there some relation between the two systems? So in particularly, we want to say, can the electron density universally determine the Hall conductivity just like in a continuum case? And the answer is we do find some relation. And that relation seems to be very generic, applies to both boson system and fermion system, quite generically. Okay. So before proceed, let me first start with some experimental motivation, so which I think this is also quite familiar to many people. So indeed, a quantum Hall system on a lattice has been proposed a long time ago by Haldane. On a honeycomb lattice, this is the first model he proposed. So basically, the electron on a lattice, instead of forming Landau levels, they form Chern band. So when that certain band have a non-zero Chern number, then when you completely fill the band, you have Hall conductivity. So this lattice version of quantum Hall effect. Indeed, such a so-called quantum anomalous Hall effect, this, because this is realized without applying external magnetic field. So such a quantum anomalous Hall effect is actually realized in chromium-doped quantum Toplow insulator thin films. So the Schreier group actually engineered such a quantum anomalous Hall materials, and then they did observe the quantization of Hall conductivity in such a system. So so this means this system can be realized in solid-state setup. And also, although fractional quantum Hall effect hasn't been convincingly realized in solid-state system, except for in graphene, that's the only case which is known. But many things have been proposed in a lattice system. For example, a while ago, people proposed that whenever we have a very flat band with non-zero Chern number, when we try to partially fill this such a flat band, then the interaction between electrons can drive the system into actually a correlated ground state, which is certain fractional quantum Hall lattice version of fractional quantum Hall states. So these many models have been proposed which can realize such a thing. So the kind of theory we proved also applies to all these kind of situations. So this is basically the kind of experimental motivation for such kind of work. But there's also a big theory motivation for us to study such kind of problem. For example, the main reason why I get interested in this problem and why I actually conjecture this result is because that I study a lot of these pi flux models. So imagine you consider a half-filled lattice model, such as on square lattice or triangular lattice. Half-filling meaning that in every unit cell you have half electron. So in this case, you start to work out the band structure. For example, with nearest neighbor hopping, you see the system always have a pair of Dirac cones. And then you try to ask yourself, can I open up a mass gap on the Dirac cone if I want to obtain some insulating ground state? And then you can convince yourself that all the possible mass terms always break certain translation symmetry, or they can break the charge conservation symmetry. So when you are looking for some insulating mass terms which doesn't break the Bose translation symmetry for the pi flux model, the only possible mass you can add in is what we call quantum anomalous whole mass. So that's the only possible mass you can add in here. There's no other mass. This means that in such a system, it's impossible to obtain naturally a trivial multi-insulator. So the only possible insulating ground state you can end up without any intrinsic topological are actually quantum hole insulators. So there is no trivial outcome. You can only end up with non-trivial things. So this motivated us to actually propose such a conjecture. So in such a, for example, in this pi flux model, is quantum hole insulator the only insulating ground state in the system without any intrinsic topological order? So indeed, actually, we prove this turned out to be the case.
Let me go back one slide again. So if we have, so we have a pi flux of every triangle, or just on?
Oh, triflux, just on the this triangle, half of the triangles, right? I want a pi flux per unit cell.
Okay.
Yeah, so one of them is zero flux, like this one.
Okay.
This one is pi flux.
Cell, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right.
You have half filling.
Yeah, exactly. Half filling meaning every site you have one electron. Yeah. The same thing for square lattice. Yeah. So actually, for Kagem lattice, it's also the same. But but honeycomb lattice is slightly different because you have two sides per unit cell. So, okay. So this is actually the real theory motivation for us to study this problem. And then in the end, we did prove such a theorem. So before I go to the idea of how to prove it, let me just first state the results of our study. So the results is the following. Imagine you consider a system with a fixed charge density rho bar per unit cell. Of course, we're assuming translation symmetry, otherwise charge density is not well defined. So imagine we have a system with translation symmetry. In this two-dimensional system, we have two translations, T1, T2. Okay, so now I can define charge density, which I call rho bar per unit cell. And I can also define flux density, which I call phi per unit cell. This flux density is defined in unit of the flux quantum. Okay, so whenever you have such a flux per unit cell, the translation symmetry, they don't commute as a usual translation. But instead, they obey that, which is so-called magnetic translation symmetry. So the magnetic translation means that when you try to commute the two translations, there are some phase comes out. Basically, whenever you have a magnetic field on lattice, it's always turned out to be the situation. Okay, so these are the input of the system. So the theorem just simply states that if we have a unique insulating ground state, insulating meaning we don't break the charge conservation symmetry, it's not a superconductor. Of course, by insulating, we also mean there is a gap in the system. Whenever we have a unique insulating ground state, this also suggests the system doesn't have ground state degeneracy, meaning it's not fractional quantum hole system. Then the following theorem has to hold, meaning that the Hall conductivity times the flux density must equal to the charge density modulo 1. So after we actually work out this result, actually, we realize that the non-interacting proof for such a theorem already exists in the literature by Dana, Avron, and Zach. But I consider that I was born in the same year as their work. I think I can be excused. Yeah, so so their idea is that you basically compute the Berry flux per in the whole Brillouin zone, and then the magnetic translation symmetry give you some idea about how to choose the boundary condition of the trend bands of the wave function of the trend bands in your system, and by choosing proper boundary condition, you can work out the whole conductivity, and then you can show that this theorem is obeyed. So there is some intuitive conclusion you can draw from the theorem. For example, you can see if the charge density changed by one, the theorem doesn't change. This is kind of natural because I can always throw one extra charge in every unit cell and let that charge just stay there. They don't contribute to Hall conductivity. They just form a single multi-insulator, and this theorem still holds. Okay. So there is another thing that the Hall conductivity and the flux density and charge density, they must be commensurate. Otherwise, it's impossible to get an interior quantum Hall effect in such a system. So by the way, by assuming a unique insulating ground state, the Hall conductivity has to be integer, so it cannot be anything. Okay, so again, this theorem is quite general. It applies to any interacting model on a lattice and doesn't care about the specific lattice form. As long as satisfy this symmetry, it will be fine. And it doesn't care actually about the particle statistics for both boson and fermion, and also both of them applies. So this, I think, is also some generalization to this old theorem, which only consider fermions in a band. And also, this theorem can be extended to fractional quantum Hall effect. And you can show that in the fractional quantum Hall effect, you get a more generalized theorem. And this case is just a simple simple limit of that theorem. Okay. So before I discuss the idea about how to prove the theorem, let me mention a few applications of the theorem.
But it doesn't tell you where the plateaus would be once you put disorder in. This is the analog of the straight line that you were talking about.
No. So that's right. So this one doesn't actually tell you what's the actual ground state. It just tells you if the ground state is insulating, is an insulator with no topological order, then it must satisfy this condition. So meaning not all insulators are allowed, only certain insulators are allowed. Yeah. So in that sense, it's sort of doesn't need fine tuning means. You mean there's no translation symmetry? Yeah, but I think the point is that before you put in disorder, there is translation symmetry. So as long as it's a gapped ground state, you can further throw in disorder. And then the same thing should also hold. Yeah, so maybe I should say it's, as long as disorder doesn't break the symmetry on the average, then the theorem should hold. Okay. All right. So the first application of the case is, of course, the well-known Hofstadter model. So in particular, the pi flux model I just mentioned earlier actually is one specific application of this case. So in pi flux model, the flux is 1/2 per unit cell, and the charge density is also 1/2. So in this case, according to the theorem, you know that the Hall conductivity has to be odd integer. It cannot be even integer, so it cannot be zero. So that means the ground state cannot be a trivial insulator. It has to be non-trivial. So this is what we call filling force quantum Hall effect on a lattice. So as long as we look at a lattice with all the number of size per unit cell, this always holds at half filling. But the honeycomb lattice is a difference. Honeycomb lattice, you have two size per unit cell. So at half filling, we actually have charge density 1 per unit cell. Okay. So if you plug this in the theorem, this tells you the Hall conductivity has to be an even integer. And indeed, this is actually the case. Because for honeycomb lattice, by the way, I'm considering pi flux on honeycomb lattice. So without pi flux, we know the band structure of honeycomb lattice is quite trivial, just the graphing. It has two Dirac cones. And when you put pi flux, you can show there are actually four Dirac cones. And then you can convince yourself that the way to gap out the four Dirac cones without breaking the translation symmetry is that you give two of the Dirac fermions the same mass psi, and the other two the same mass psi. But these two pairs, they can have different size. So this means that when you add them up, you are always adding up some even integer, because every pair of Dirac cones actually give you some even integer. So therefore, the Hall conductivity always have some 0 modulo 2. It's always an even integer. So in free fermion cases, it has been shown that people have found quantum Hall effects with Hall conductance plus or minus 2. And in fact, in interacting boson system, this is always found to be true. So previously, there's some DMRG study on a pi flux model with actually this one filling per unit cell. So in this case, what people found is the ground state is an integer quantum Hall state of boson. And in that case, again, you have Hall conductance 2. It's not a 1. Okay. So this is maybe some kind of confirmation of this theorem, of the realization of the theorem in some model. So the other application of this theorem is actually some magnetic insulator system.
What's the symmetries you have to obey?
Sorry?
What are the unbroken symmetries again?
Oh, it's translation.
It's translation.
Magnetic translation.
What?
Magnetic translation. Meaning we apply magnetic field to the system. So the two translation does not commute. Yeah. Okay. So the second application of the system is actually less obvious. These are the magnetic insulators. So one significant example is actually this so-called quarter field triangular lattice or the honeycomb lattice. So for triangular honeycomb lattice or Kakemie lattice, the Brillouin zone is actually a hexagon. So when you quarter field it, meaning the area of the Brillouin zone is actually 7 out of 8 of the whole Brillouin zone area. So the Fermi surface, you can show that, with only nearest neighbor hopping, the Fermi surface has perfect nesting. So in that case, whenever you throw in some interacting into the fermions, the interaction will stabilize actually a so-called chiral charge density wave state. So the so-called chiral charge density wave state is actually a compromise of all three nesting vectors. We have Q1, Q2, Q3. So this so-called chiral SDW state actually make use of all three ordering vectors. So in particular, on a, for example, a triangular lattice, such a state was first found out by Ivan Martin, Batista, and Tao Li. So in that case, the magnetic order looks like this in real space. So you see the lattice, the magnetic unit cell is actually quadrupled. You have four different sublattices. And the spin direction for the four different sublattices are quite different. Their direction is basically starting from the center of the cubic. They point into the four points on the corner of the, such a cubic. So in such a system, you can show that whenever such a magnetic order is formed, there is still some residual symmetry in the system, right? Presumably, you would assume that the two translations, T1 and T2, is actually broken in such a case. But actually, this is not true. So in particular, if you look carefully, the four sublattices, their spin direction is 1, 1, 1, 1, minus 1, minus 1, for example, from 1 to 2. So now if you apply translation along this direction, followed by a spin rotation, 180-degree spin rotation along x-axis, you can see the second and third component of spin orientation flips. So that maps 1 to 2. So this means translation followed by a spin rotation makes the magnetic order come back to itself. So the system has some unbroken magnetic translation symmetry, so translation followed by spin rotation. So in particular, in both directions, you have such a magnetic translation symmetry. And then you can show, again, these two symmetry, because of spin rotation, they anti-commute. So this is exactly the magnetic translation algebra we discussed earlier. So classically, you could view that effectively there is some magnetic flux in every unit cell because of spin chirality. You could classically compute the spin chirality giving rise to some Berry flux, which is S1 dot S2 cross S3. You add them up, and then you can also convince yourself there is effectively a pi flux per unit cell. So in that case, effectively we have a pi flux for the insulating ground state. And the filling is what we call quarter filling because we have both spin species. So in this case, the Hall conductivity, according to our theorem, must be 1 modulo 2. Again, it has to be a quantum Hall insulator. It cannot be a trivial insulator in this case. Okay. So now these are the two possible applications of such a theorem to a solid-state system. One is Hofstadter model. The other one is magnetic insulators. So in the next, I'm going to discuss our proof. So the proof is based on the flux insertion trick. So there are actually two different versions of the proof. The first proof based on edge state. So the idea is to cut a torus into some cylinder, and then we use a flux insertion to give you something. And the second proof doesn't rely on edge states. So I would actually show you both proof and give a little bit comparison on both cases. So the first proof is actually quite similar to this proof of Lipschitz-Matthes theorem. So before I go into that proof, let me just remind you a little bit about the idea of Lipschitz-Matthes theorem. So Lipschitz-Matthes theorem, later generalized by Masaki and Hastings, which is called LSMOH theorem. So in such a theorem, the idea is that simplest example is we study actually half-field system in one dimension. Or for example, a spin chain. Because every spin can be mapped as to a hardcore boson. And a hardcore boson is half-field, has density 1/2 per unit cell. So in this case, you start to thread flux in the system. After threading flux, the coupling constant on the link start to get some phase vector. So after you insert, in total, a 2 pi flux to the system, you can show the new Hamiltonian and the original Hamiltonian are gauge equivalent. They are related by a gauge transformation. So in this adiabatic flux insertion process, we start by assuming the system have a gapped ground state, unique gapped ground state, which is separated by all the other excited state by a finite energy gap. And as I start to insert flux, we assume the flux insertion is slow enough. The time scale of the flux insertion is actually much smaller than 1 over the gap, which is another time scale in the system. We assume that relation, and then we ask ourselves, okay, what's the conclusion after the flux insertion? Because we know after inserting 2 pi flux, we end up with another model with the same spectrum as the origin model, because they are related by a large gauge transformation in the system. So in particular, let's consider the model with before flux insertion to be H0, meaning no flux, and the model after flux insertion to be H5 naught. Phi naught is one flux quantum spreading through this one-dimensional chain. Okay, so these two models are related by a large gauge transformation, because if you compute any gauge-independent quantity in the two models, they are actually the same. So they must have the same spectrum. They're just related by a large gauge transformation. And such a large gauge transformation, this operator, is nothing but the polarization operator of this one-dimensional chain. So for this Hamiltonian H0 before flux insertion, let me call its ground state to be 0. for this model H50, meaning when you after you insert 2π flux, let me call the ground state to be phi0. So in this adiabatic flux insertion process, because the whole thing is adiabatic, so basically these two ground state of the system are related by a unitary time evolution operator. So this H5 is basically the Hamiltonian at a specific time t. So at time t equal to 0, the flux is 0, with phi 0. At time t equal to capital T, the flux is phi naught. It's 2π flux throughout the whole one-dimensional chain. So as we said, the two systems have the same spectrum. So one ground state is mapped to the other ground state of the new model. But we also know the two Hamiltonian actually are related by a large gauge transformation. So the ground state phi naught, based on ground state phi naught, after applying such a large gauge transformation, we can construct a new ground state of this H0, this original Hamiltonian, by applying it on the ground state of the new Hamiltonian. So therefore, after flux insertion trick emitted by used by Masaki, we actually end up with a new ground state of the original model H0. And we ask ourselves, well, how different is this new ground state compared to the original ground state 0? It turns out they are quite different. In particular, their momentum are different. So the classical picture of this is very simple. After the flux insertion process, you apply some time-dependent vector potential on the link. So that time-dependent vector potential gives you some electric field. After you apply electric field to the system, momentum changes. That's the classical picture. But quantum mechanically, you can actually compute the difference of the momentum of this new ground state and the old ground state. In particular, these two ground states, they have the same momentum. Because in the flux insertion process, the Hamiltonian always preserves transition symmetry. So these two ground states have the same momentum. But such a gauge transformation, the polarization operator, it doesn't commute with translation operator along the link. So when you compute commutator of the translation and this large gauge transformation, you can show their commutator is actually proportional to exponential minus 2 pi I times rho bar. Rho bar is density per side. So if such a rho bar is not an integer, then this means this new ground state and the original ground state, they have different density. Oh, sorry, different momentum. So they have to be orthogonal. So this is basically the idea of Lipschitz-Matthews theorem. So by comparing the two different ground states after flux insertion, you show that it's impossible to have a unique ground state in a system separated by the other states by a finite energy gap. So we're going to use this kind of idea, but applying it to a two-dimensional system. So
yeah, I'm just confused. Is it flux through a plaquette or?
Oh, this is just one-dimensional chain. It's closed 1D chain. So
okay, so it's a flux through the chains.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Okay. So now we come to the two-dimensional case. So in two-dimensional case, the physical system we are actually considering is a torus. But the trick is that we cut the torus into lots of cylinders. So if you look at, for example, if I look at this cylinder along this y direction, or the actually in this picture it's called T2 direction, A2 direction. Along this direction is periodic, but along this A1 direction is open, right? So I can view it effectively as a one-dimensional chain along the A2 direction. And if I choose the number of unit cell along the A1 direction to be proper along such a chain, I can find an analogy of this half charge per unit cell in the 1D chain case. So in particular, we did choose such a limit to make sure that in every unit cell of this one-dimensional chain, every unit cell has a fractional charge. So, and then we start to insert flux. So if we start to insert flux in that case, then we know that the ground state, the momentum is going to change, right? So it has to go to a different ground state. So, but here we're looking at a cylinder, not really just a one-dimensional chain. So in addition to the possibility that the bulk is gapless, there's another possibility that the bulk is gapped, but we have gapless edge state in this two-dimensional cylinder. So if we have gapless edge state, it still does not contradict to the previous result that the momentum is going to change after the flux insertion process. So in this case, we can show that if the bulk is fully gapped, there must be edge state in this case. And the change of momentum in such a situation is coming from the edge state. And the next thing we're going to rely on edge state to prove the theorem between Hall connectivity and the filling number. So because such a cylinder, as we see, if the bulk is fully gapped, already have two edge, left edge and right edge, So we assume the change of momentum at the left edge and the change of momentum at the right edge to be delta PL and delta PR. So these two things add up together must give you the total change of momentum for the whole cylinder. And that total change of momentum is nothing but 2 pi rho bar times L1, the same thing as previous Lipschitz-Mathey theorem. OK, so this is the first condition. So the second condition we apply is that we ask ourselves, OK, if I look at some one-dimensional edge state, if I start to insert flux, how does the momentum change in such a system? So in particular, let's just look at a very familiar example of one-dimensional electron gas. So this is actually known as the Luttinger theorem. So if you start to insert flux through this one-dimensional system, then basically every mode will start to move, right? If you have a fixed Fermi energy, this mode actually goes down the Fermi energy, and this mode actually goes up out of the Fermi energy. So a new state becomes filled on the left-hand side, and a new state becomes unfilled on the right-hand side. So this means I have one more state here, one less state here. So the momentum change is proportional to the difference between the momentum of the two Fermi wave vector, right? So this idea is basically Luttinger theorem. The change of momentum after flux insertion is 2 pi times the density of the one-dimensional system, because the difference of the Fermi wave vector at these two points is nothing but the density of 1D chain. So you can actually generalize this to interacting system for any edge state of a quantum Hall system. By using field theory argument, you can show that this is also true. The change of momentum after flux insertion is proportional to the density on the edge, and the coefficient is simply 2 pi. OK. So therefore, yes?
Are you assuming the particles on the modes on the edge carries charge 1 here? Would that do you need to assume that?
No, I don't need to assume that. Yeah. Like even for Laughlin state, their edge is also OK. This is just a simple picture, just to convince you that. But you can, say, assume something like a abelian transaminant theory, and then look at their edge state, and then explicitly check this is also true. Yeah. This is just a general result. So this is a second relation. So it relates the change of momentum on every edge to the density on every edge. Now the third step is that we look at the difference between the different cylinders. So note that I previously cut the torus into a cylinder. So notice that the system actually have a magnetic translation symmetry, right? So meaning that the different cylinders, they are not completely completely unrelated. They are actually related by magnetic translation symmetry. In particular, if one of the cylinders has certain lengths, which I call L1. So if one of the cylinders has a length L1, then after translation along T1 direction by L1 units, it becomes a second cylinder, right? So the two cylinders are related by magnetic translation symmetry. So a magnetic translation is simply the usual translation followed by a gauge transformation. But we know these edge state, in particular edge state quantum Hall system, are not gauge invariant. If you apply a gauge transformation, the density of edge changes. So therefore, the density of the left edge of this cylinder and density of left edge on this cylinder are different. After you apply a gauge transformation, they become different. So and that difference is nothing but Hall conductivity times flux in the system. This is because a large gauge transformation actually insert a flux by times L1 when you go from this cylinder to this cylinder. So therefore, the density of these two edge states are actually related. So now we have three equations. One equation relates the change of momentum, which is the same as the charge density per unit cell, to the density of the two edges, according to this generalized Luttinger theorem. And another relation tells you that the density of the edge state of the first cylinder and second cylinder are related by this relation. And the third relation is that now we try to glue the cylinder back to form a torus. Whenever we get back to a torus, we know that if I start to insert flux, there's no change of momentum, right? Because the torus has no boundary, no change of momentum. And also, you don't have fractional filling. So torus has no change of momentum. So this means the change of momentum on the right edge of the first one must cancel the change of momentum on the left edge of the second one. They must cancel each other. So by requiring all these conditions, you can work out the algebra and then exactly get the relation that sigma xy is the same as sigma xy times phi is the same as rho bar in modulo 1. So this is a kind of one proof based on edge state. So there is another proof based on a flux insertion operator on a torus without resulting to edge state. And I'm also going to briefly discuss that. So in this case, we consider specifically a Landau gauge in such a system. So meaning that the system have two translations, T1 and T2. So the translation T2 is just the usual translation. And the T1, notice that After Landau gauge, the hopping, we choose the following Landau gauge such that the hopping along y-axis is different along different vertical lengths. And the first vertical length, say, is positive. The second one is negative for pi flux model. So this is the Landau gauge we choose. So in particular, we also choose the circumference of the cylinder to satisfy certain conditions so that the flux incorporated in every column is not an integer flux. It's some fractional flux. This is just specific choice. So after that choice, you can show the system actually does not have any transition anymore. But in contrary, the system actually have some emergent symmetry. That emergent symmetry is actually a translation followed by a flux insertion. This is because if I start to insert flux thread this cylinder, through this torus, if I start to insert flux through this torus, the hopping links are going to obtain some some phase, right? So the first vertical link is start to change. And when the phase is enough, after I insert enough flux, it becomes the phase of the second link. So this means after a certain flux insertion, I also do a transition along x direction. The whole thing goes back. So this is some emergent symmetry of the ground state manifold, is that after flux insertion followed by a translation, the system actually goes back. So this is some emergent symmetry of the system, translation followed by flux insertion. Another symmetry of the ground state manifold is similar to the previous thing we discussed in Lipschitz-Matthews theorem, is that after you insert flux 2 pi along the y direction, meaning that these horizontal links obtain some phase vector after the flux insertion. After you do that, you do a gauge transformation. This is 2 pi flux insertion. So this is not actually a 2 pi flux insertion. So after the 2 pi flux insertion, you do a gauge transformation, system goes back. So this is not the emergent symmetry of the system. So you have two emergent symmetry in the ground state manifold. If we assume the ground state is unique, then every symmetry must form a 1D representation in the ground state, meaning they are just a phase vector. So the two symmetry must commute on the ground state. But when you start to explicitly compute the commutator of these two operators, you can show that the flux insertion operator F2 and F1, they don't necessarily commute. This is because when you start to insert flux, there is also charge pumped in the process if the system have Hall conductivity. So, and that charge is proportional to the flux insertion. So if you compute their commutator, you can show that such a commutator actually shows up. And also, there is another part of the commutator, which is the translation and this polarization operator, they don't commute. So we have two contributions to the commutator. And since we said if we assume unique ground state, both symmetry must be just a phase vector, so they must commute with each other. So by doing that, by assuming that they actually commute on a unique ground state, we can show that the whole theorem still holds. Okay, so so basically we have shown that such a theorem can be argued in both a approach considering edge state and in another approach considering no edge state. So it just holds quite generally. So okay, let me just give a quick recap. So again, the theorem is that the Hall conductance times the flux density per unit cell must be equal to the charge density per unit cell, modulo 1. This is assuming the system have a unique ground state, unique insulating ground state, meaning it's an integral quantum Hall effect. But if the system actually have topological order, that's a different situation, meaning you have ground state degeneracy. So the next question we're going to ask is that how do we understand fractional quantum Hall effects? And also, there is another interesting question is that whenever, in certain cases, such as pi flux models, the system actually have time-reversal symmetry. So can we also say something in that situation? Yeah, so next I'm going to briefly discuss the how many time do I have? Okay, the following I'm going to discuss the fractional quantum Hall effects and the also the time-reversal invariant case. So the difference between the integer and fractional quantum Hall case is that for fractional quantum Hall case, we have degenerate ground states, for example, on a torus. And we have anions in the system, unlike the integer quantum Hall case. So so to understand the fractional quantum Hall case, actually a simplest way to think about it is to view the flux insertion process in a slightly different way. So the original flux insertion argument can be also viewed in this from this perspective, is that you start to have a flux. This is just a flux tube, very thin flux tube is outside this torus. Now I'm trying to insert a flux into the center of the torus. What I do is that I move this flux tube gradually into this cylinder. But as the flux tube start to penetrate the cylinder, it punched two holes on the cylinder, right? So And then after it moves into the cylinder, the two holes start to merge into one. Okay, so let me show this again. So when you start to move such a flux tube into the cylinder, you first create a pair of holes punched on the cylinder. So every hole is simply a 2-pi flux penetrating such a cylinder. Okay, so basically you create a pair of 2-pi flux out of nowhere on the cylinder, and then braid them around this circumference of the cylinder, and then annihilate them, and then move them into the center of the cylinder. Okay, so this is a different way to view this flux insertion process. So this is what we call a fluxon braiding picture, because effectively you are creating a pair of fluxon and then braid them around the whole cylinder and then annihilate them. So because therefore such a flux insertion operator is the same as creation and annihilation of 2-pi fluxon pairs. So I think this idea is first proposed by Wen and Niu in the early days of quantum Hall. So we're going to view our flux insertion process from this perspective. So in particular, what we're specifically going to do is to consider this commutator we just computed. Okay. So this commutator, which we computed in the type of Lipschitz-Matisse type of theorem, is the following. I first do a flux insertion in the system, then I measure the momentum, and then I remove the flux insertion, and then I also measure the momentum. After the removing of the flux insertion, then I compare the two different momentum. And the difference between the two different momentum is simply given by the charge density per unit cell. So that's the idea of the original Lipschitz-Matisse theorem. Okay. And in particular, this flux insertion operator is written as this pure flux insertion operator followed by a large gauge transformation in the case. So pictorically, how can you view this process? First of all, you insert a flux, right, by this operator F2. Like we previously said, when you try to insert a flux through the hole of the cylinder, it's the same as first punch a 2-pi hole on the cylinder. This is what we call create a fluxon. And then we move this fluxon across the cylinder. So this whole process is simply the same as inserting a flux through the hole of the cylinder. Okay, so pictorically, the first step, this F2 operator, is known as is moving this fluxon. And the second step is to translate the fluxon by one unit cell. And now I'm doing the flux insertion back, moving them back to the system. And the final step is actually do a translation back into the system. Okay. So in this whole process, what you can see is that this obviously is simply you are just braiding this 2-pi fluxon in this closed loop. So basically, this whole change of momentum, its whole process is simply the braiding phase of a 2-pi fluxon in the system. So that's simply what you are computing in this whole process. So interesting thing is that if we assume the system is a fractional quantum Hall system, we ask if I start to braid a 2-pi flux around such a closed loop, what are the very phase we're going to obtain in this flux tube? And the answer is actually no. The answer comes from two contributions. The first contribution is what we call AB phase. So by the way, these two contributions are derived from the effective field theory. So by assuming if it's a billion quantum Hall system, they can always be described by a transaminant theory. And in your transaminant theory, you can show that you obtain some Berry phase after braiding certain flux through such a closed loop. Okay, so the first contribution is what we call AB phase. It can be simply understood in the following way. So by creating such a fluxon, 2-pi flux, there is some charge which is polarized near this fluxon. The charge is equal to sigma xy. Okay, there's a charge because 2-pi flux is a 1 plus 1 term. So the charge polarized around is sigma xy times 1. Okay, so when you braid such a charge around a flux, because we know that there are background flux in the system, right? We have finite flux per unit cell. So after you go through that process, when charge goes around the flux, it's this Berry phase. It's AB phase, Ahronoff-Bohm phase, and the phase is equal to sigma xy times finite times L. L is the length of the cylinder. Okay, and the second contribution is what we call anion phase, braiding phase. This is because the fluxon, a 2-pi flux in a fractional quantum Hall system, they are not actually a local excitation. They can be fractional excitation. For example, in a Neukölln 1/2 Loefling state, the flux is actually a semion in the system. So it carry fractional statistics. So in a lattice system, whenever you have a unit cell, you can also put another anion, which we call A, in every unit cell. And by translation symmetry, the anion per unit, for every unit cell must be the same, simply guaranteed by translation. So therefore, when you go through such a process, you also obtain some Berry phase. This Berry phase is nothing but a breeding statistic between a flux on which we call F and the anion per unit cell, which we call A. And of course, for every unit cell, you have anion A. So when you go through such a closed loop, because the length is L, there is also a factor of L. Okay. So therefore, the breeding statistics also give you another different contribution. So for integer quantum Hall effect, such a thing doesn't exist because there is no anion in such a system. But for fraction quantum Hall effect, such an effect does exist. So therefore, this breeding phase with the background anion also contribute to the change of momentum in the whole process. So therefore, this whole change of momentum must equal to the contribution coming from this part times the contribution coming from this part. So therefore, you get simply this equation, that the charge density per unit cell is the same as Hall connectivity times flux density plus this breeding phase. This is the mutual breeding phase between the 2 pi flux and the background anion per unit cell divided by 2 pi. So one simple corollary of such a theorem is that now I can start to insert a 2 pi flux per unit cell. If I insert 2 pi flux per unit cell, an extra 2 pi flux, this is simply the same as adding one more fluxon per unit cell. So the background anion is increased by one more fluxon. So this means if I change phi from 0 to 1, this background anion is changed from A to A times F. F is a fluxon. So therefore, a corollary of such a theorem is basically that the Hall conductance times 2 pi is the same as breeding phases of the 2 pi fluxon, modular 2 pi. So this is some well-known case, well-known result in a quantum Hall system. Okay, so this is some generic conclusion you can draw for a fraction quantum Hall system. So let me just mention a few concrete examples.
Question.
Yes.
The fluxon anion, it's not unique, right? You can, or.
Oh, F fluxon.
Yeah.
Is unique. Like Laughlin state is.
What about adding another
fermion? Or boson. That will change the charge, right? The charge is fixed. You are probably thinking about some dynamical process, or yeah. So there is a way to well define the fluxon. Yeah. Okay. So let me just mention a few examples. So the first example is just the Z2 spin liquids in a Morton insulator. By a Morton insulator, I mean there is an odd number of spin 1/2 per unit cell. So in this case, the fluxon 2 pi flux. So by the way, if it's a spin 1/2 system per unit cell, we can map the spin system to a hardcore boson again. So that's the same as saying I have half charge per unit cell. Okay. So the 2 pi flux in the system, in such a spin liquid system, is what usually people call Vison. So in Kitaev's toric code model, it's just the particle M. Okay. And the background anion in the system is actually a spinon, because in every unit cell you have spin 1/2. Okay. So the background anion is spinon. So the breeding statistics of them is pi. Okay. So in that case, we have no flux per unit cell in a usual, say, Heisenberg model. And the charge density is 1/2 per unit cell. And the Hall conductivity is, of course, 0. And then you simply get the conclusion that 1/2 is the same as pi divided by 2 pi. Okay. So this is the simplest case. And the next case is a chiral spin liquid on a lattice. The chiral spin liquid also have half charge per unit cell. And there is no flux, assuming we're also considering Heisenberg model. And in that case, the both the fluxon and background anion is a semion. It carries spin 1/2. This is also called a spinon in a chiral spin liquid. So in this case, the statistic between the two semions is actually pi. They're breeding statistics, okay, not half breeding. Breeding statistics is pi. So in this case, it's also satisfied. 1/2 is the same as pi divided by 2 pi. So there's also another case, which is a usual fractional chain insulator. This, I think, is one of the first chain insulators proposing this flat term band by Chamon's group. So in this case, the charge density, they choose charge density to be 1/6, and it's a pi flux model on square lattice. So the flux is also 1/2, and sigma xy is 1/3. So there's no background anion in that case. Okay, so basically, for any fractional quantum Hall system on a lattice, as long as the system has magnetic translation, such a conclusion must also hold. Okay, so far, I mostly focused on the time-Russell breaking case. So in the next, I'm going to also briefly discuss a case with time-Russell symmetry. So that case is a special case where the flux density is actually always 1/2, meaning pi flux. Because if you apply a different flux to the lattice, it's going to break time-Russell. Pi flux is a special one. So for Pi flux case, I'm going to consider a case which is also half-filling. Half-filling meaning charge density is 1 per unit cell. Okay. Charge density is 1 per unit cell, and also I'm considering spin 1/2 Bermion in such a system. Imagine I assume the magnetic translation, meaning the two translation anti-commutative token. This is just simply saying there is a pi flux per unit cell. And I'm also assuming time Russell symmetry, T squared is minus 1, this Kramer's doubling, Kramer's theorem. So so in this case, for example, on triangle lattice, a simple realization of the pi flux is at such a hopping model. So these green links have negative hopping. The other links have positive hopping. This gives you a pi flux per unit cell. Okay. Again, there's only pi flux for the down triangles. For up triangles, you don't have any flux. Okay. So this is simply a pi flux model. So the theorem simply states that if you end up with the insulating ground state, with the insulating unique ground state, with no ground state degeneracy, then the ground state has to be a quantum spin Hall insulator. So of course, in this case, if you have a spin conservation, then you can just simply use our previous theorem. Because for spin up and spin down, their density is both 1/2. So for everyone, it has to be a quantum Hall insulator with all the Hall conductors. So in that case, if you have a spin up, Tran number to be plus 1, spin down, Tran number minus 1, this is simply realizing quantum spin Hall. But the thing is, you don't need to require spin conservation. You just need to require timer. So you can also show that in this case, the ground state has to be a quantum spin Hall insulator. So in particular, in terms of realization, what you can show is that with only these nearest neighbor hopping, you just have these Dirac cones. And when you turn on a spin orbit coupling, nearest neighbor spin orbit coupling, along any direction, you just need a unidirectional spin orbit coupling. In fact, in coded atom, these unidirectional spin orbit coupling, such as something like Px times sigma y, can be realized by a Raman laser. And it has been realized in the continuum. So in such a system, when you add such a unidirectional spin orbit coupling, meaning it's spin-dependent imaginary hopping, some small number, then you immediately open up a gap here, and the system has to be a quantum spin Hall insulator. Okay, so in the following, I'm also give you some simple argument why the ground state has to be a quantum spin Hall insulator. So this is just a band structure. Okay, but in fact, you can prove this conclusion quite generically when you have interaction in the system. So there is a generalization of Lipschitz-Matisse Oshikawa-Hastings theorem to time Russell symmetric case made recently by Mike Zeltel and Ashwin Vishwanath and his group. So so in this case, what they have shown that if you have a translation symmetry in the system, then every unit cell must have even number of Kramer's doublet. Otherwise, it's impossible to obtain a unique insulating ground state in such a system. It's like if you have a single spin 1/2 per unit cell, it's impossible to end up with such a system. So you must have two spin 1/2 or spin 1 in every unit cell. Then in that case, you can end up with a unique ground state with a gap. Okay, so in our case, for every unit cell, I have one charge, right? According to this Kramer's theorem, T squared equal to minus 1, such a one charge is a single Kramer doublet. Okay, so right now the charge already give you one Kramer's doublet in the system. But in addition to the charge, you also have pi flux per unit cell. So the question is, you want to ask yourself is, does pi flux also provide a Kramer's doublet or not? In fact, a crucial difference between quantum spin Hall insulator and a trivial insulator is that a pi flux in a quantum spin Hall insulator is exactly a Kramer's doublet. But the pi flux in a trivial insulator is not a Kramer's doublet. So therefore, for a quantum spin Hall insulator, you have a pi flux give you a Kramer's doublet, and one charge also give you a Kramer's doublet. So you have two Kramer's doublet per unit cell. So you can end up with a unique ground state with a gap. But whenever you have a trivial insulator, you only have the one charge per unit cell. So you are not going to end up with a trivial multi insulator. It's impossible, incompatible with time Russell symmetry. The only possibility is that you end up with a quantum spin Hall insulator in such a system. And such a system can possibly be engineered in cold atom system, because they can use shaking and Raman lasering to produce a flux. And they can also use Raman laser to produce such a spin orbit coupling, uniaxial spin orbit coupling in the system. Okay, so with this, I'd like to conclude. So what we have shown is that for a lattice system, whenever you require magnetic translation and the charge conservation, you can show that Hall conductance must satisfy a certain equation associated with the flux density and charge density in the system. This means if I give you the microscopic input, which is charge density and flux density, I already know a lot of information about Hall conductance if the ground state is a gapped unique insulator. And also, such And this theorem we proved applies to both boson and fermion system with arbitrary interaction, as long as the ground state is unique gapped insulator. So we can also generalize such a theorem to a fractional quantum Hall case and timeless Hall invariant case. We can show that some cases we have symmetry enforced quantum spin Hall insulator at certain filling. So with this, I'd like to thank for your attention.
Yesterday, Mason gave a talk and discussed
symmetry factorization.
Yeah. But also, he had the result about cancellation invariance.
Yeah, so I think in that case, you can probably, one thing you can think about is to gauge the fermion parity, and then it becomes SET. You can ask yourself, whether it's compatible with SET or not.
So is that related to?
Yeah, for example, in this case, you can gauge Z2 fermion parity. That's SET. And that's basically, that SET is nothing but actually a toric code. Then you can ask yourself, with translation and the timer, so is that compatible with toric code? And it turns out only the quantum spin Hall one is possible, meaning in that case, the Vison, meaning that the Vison actually carry a pi phase under timer, so that's the only possibility. Yeah, the other the other case where the Vison doesn't have a timer, so project orientation of timer, so is impossible.
So can that be cast into the H4 whatever instruction language?
I don't know. This is not a, oh, you mean the other case?
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah.
Other questions? Okay, let's thank you.